Welcome back. We'll now return to the Mediterranean Sea and to the Near Eastern world to see what was happening there at the same time that Asoka was ruling in India and Xu Huangdi was in China. With the death of Alexander the Great in 323 BC, the Hellenistic period of history had begun. And it's called that because Alexander's Greek and Macedonian generals now had political control over a set of kingdoms that stretched from Greece all the way to the borders of India, and because Greek culture now dominated throughout all that area. The Hellenistic period was a time of almost constant warfare, and this is also a time of hereditary monarchies, so there's no more of those experimental democracies around anymore. It was a time of absolute rulers, such as Antigonus, Seleucus, and Ptolemy. And the wars created by these authoritarian monarchs caused widespread suffering, and there was mass enslavement. It's a time of relatively high injustice and unhappiness. Now, because the net result of all of this fighting was more or less a 300-year stalemate, that's about all I'm going to say about Hellenistic politics. But instead, I want to focus on the areas in which there are dramatic and creative new developments. And the real richness and originality of the Hellenistic era lie not in its politics, but in realms such as philosophy, science, and art. Just as the Upanishads and Jains had appeared in India as a response to the religious conformity and the political disunity of the late Vedic age, and just like Confucianism, legalism, and Taoism developed in China out of all the chaos of the Warring States period, so too the political confusion and the oppression found in the Hellenistic era seemed to spark an intellectual response in the form of several new schools of philosophy. And all of these were concerned with the issue of how can one live a moral or even proper life during such troubled times. One of these new philosophical schools was Epicureanism. It's named after its founder, Epicurus. And the Epicureans believed that the goal of existence was to attempt to achieve a state of tranquility in which you were free from pain or fear. Now, this was accomplished very literally by avoiding things that cause pain or even unpleasantness, and conversely, by seeking out experiences that were pleasurable. Now, today, the word Epicurean has connotations of excess, especially in regards to food. But it's important to realize that a key aspect of ancient Epicureanism was moderation. So, you should enjoy physical pleasures, but you should very much avoid overindulgence in them. The Epicureans believed in basically withdrawing from society. So, you should not really be active in politics, there's no point. Instead, you should live a quiet, intellectual life. And this really represents a complete reversal, the opposite, of the earlier Greek emphasis on active civic involvement. But what it does reflect is the new political realities of the Hellenistic era, where individuals no longer play a role in politics. So it's a philosophy of seclusion, and not surprisingly, it was especially popular with wealthy men. So they could retreat to their nice country villas, where they would socialize with a close circle of their buddies, and basically kind of turn their back on the world, not worry about the world's problems, but try to make their lives as nice as possible. An alternative school of philosophy that developed at the same time was Stoicism. This was founded by a man named Zeno. And it represents a very different kind of response to the same problems of the Hellenistic age. The Stoics were a little bit more pessimistic in their outlook. So they thought, yeah, the world is probably a bad place, but you still have to endure whatever you encounter. And it's important to press on, even in the face of adversity. So they still had a very strong ethos of helping others. And so, unlike the inward-looking Epicureans, they are an outward-facing philosophy, which said that it's your duty to stay involved in society and to just do the best you could, even when they kind of suspected that these actions might be futile or really just always doomed to failure. The key concept for the Stoics was the idea of virtue. Virtue is something they talk about a lot. Virtue to them was the highest good. And the way that you acquired virtue was by doing positive actions. And if you got virtue, you would at least be content. Now, if you were able to attain virtue, then everything else, health, wealth, status, none of it matters. So Stoicism is a philosophy that mixes together acceptance of misfortune with always making an effort to make things better. The third major new philosophical school of this time, we can also see their beliefs as a response to some negative aspects of Hellenistic culture. But their ideas were by far the most radical. This was a group called the Cynics, and they advocated living a life of unreserved, brutal honesty. This, among other things, led them to completely reject all forms of authority. They didn't recognize it, all forms of government, and even normal social structures and conventions. All of these things, they just said, were artificial constructs that had no basis in nature. So the Cynics believed that people were basically animals, and that when we try to pretend we're anything more than that, it's just hypocrisy. So Cynics also shunned all material products of civilization. So they didn't believe in personal possessions, and usually Cynics would be encountered homeless and naked. This rather extreme lifestyle led their critics to pejoratively refer to them as dogs. And that nickname stuck. And this is actually the source of the name by which they became known, since the term cynic is derived from the Greek word kuon, which means dog. That's also, by the way, the same root of the English word canine. So think of cynics as kind of dropouts from society. They reject everything about society. And their adherence to this life of total honesty often resulted in other people considering them to be very rude and obnoxious, since one of the things a cynic would do is he would tell you exactly what he thought. So if he didn't like you, he would say, "I hate you." And the cynics would often seem to take pleasure in making fun of what they saw as the pretensions of society. Totally in keeping with this whole anti-authoritarian stance, the cynics didn't recognize any founder or leader, even among themselves. But clearly the most famous cynic was a guy named Diogenes. And there's lots and lots of stories about Diogenes which illustrate the cynic mindset. So, for example, he supposedly went around naked, he lived by the road in a big abandoned clay pot, and the only thing that he owned was a crude wooden bowl. Well, according to one of these stories, one day Diogenes saw a poor farm boy coming down to the stream and drinking the water by cupping his hands. And this sight immediately filled Diogenes with self-disgust and loathing at his own indulgence for owning the luxury of a bowl. So he immediately smashed his wooden bowl and from then on just drank with his hands. Diogenes ended up at Athens, where he had a nice run-in with the famous philosopher Plato. At a lecture that Plato was giving, Plato presented a definition of man as an animal that walks on two legs and lacks feathers. Diogenes overheard this, so Diogenes went and grabbed a chicken, he plucked it, and then he brings it into the lecture hall and presents it to Plato saying, "Here's your man." Another story features a famous historical figure, and it says that one day Diogenes was, again, lying in the sun by the side of the road, and Alexander the Great and his entourage came riding by on their horses. Alexander recognized Diogenes, and he admired him for his honesty. So Alexander stopped and said, I'll reward you with anything that you ask for. Well, supposedly Diogenes just kind of glanced up at Alexander with a sour expression and snarled the reply that the only thing that Alexander could do for him was to move along because he was blocking the sunlight. The philosophy and lifestyle of the Cynics, with their rejection of cultural conventions, dropping out of society, and living in this state of nature, are interestingly reminiscent of both the Upanishadic mystics of India and some of the Taoist sages of China. There's even one story concerning a famous early Taoist named Chuang Tzu, which mirrors almost exactly that of Diogenes and Alexander. So according to this story, the local ruler who had heard about this sage's wisdom sent a messenger to go find him out in the wilderness where he lived and to offer him a high-ranking position at court. This would be every Chinese person's greatest ambition. Irritated at being bothered, Chuang Tzu instead gives a very curt reply, which I think Diogenes certainly would have appreciated. So the Chinese sage simply said, "Go away. Don't mess with me. I prefer to enjoy myself in the mud. I will never accept such an office, but I will remain free so that I can do what I want." While the Epicureans, Stoics, and Cynics all represent strands of philosophy that we can see as direct responses to historical developments of the Hellenistic era, the most famous Hellenistic philosopher of all really lived right at the beginning of this period. And this, of course, is Aristotle, who had been Alexander's tutor. In his youth, Aristotle had been a student of Plato at Plato's Academy. But Aristotle goes on to develop very, very different interests from those of his teacher Plato. So where Plato had focused his inquiry on aspects of the mind and on pure thought, and Plato believed that the physical world is just an illusion, Aristotle devoted enormous effort towards studying very intently the world that was around him and that could be perceived with his senses. Aristotle was interested in almost everything. He wrote a lot also, and so he authored groundbreaking and very influential treatises about a dazzling array of topics. He wrote about politics, ethics, physics, biology, literature, music, rhetoric, zoology, theater, and metaphysics. His study of the natural world led to his famous efforts to catalog and classify things in nature, such as fish and animals. And he was a big believer in systematically collecting data, comparing what you had found, and then drawing conclusions from it. So just like Plato, he wrote about ideal political structures and the ideal state. But the two methodologies used by these two philosophers, I think, reveal something very fundamental about their differences. So Plato, on the one hand, simply sat down and dreamed up his ideal republic, using only his mind. Whereas Aristotle went out, collected the actual constitutions of 158 different states, analyzed and compared them, and then selected what he considered to be the best elements of each. Many philosophers of this time, like Aristotle, were also what today we would call scientists. And the Hellenistic era saw important new inventions and discoveries in fields such as science, medicine, engineering, and mathematics. For example, the mathematician Euclid, who we call the father of geometry, lived and worked in Hellenistic Alexandria. And his most important contribution was a book called The Elements, in which Euclid basically laid out all the basic principles of geometry. He's the one who came up with a lot of the proofs and theorems that are still used today. And as well as being a pioneer in axioms involving complex shapes and angles. The Elements is probably the single most successful school textbook ever written. And that's because all the way from when he wrote it up until the 19th century, Euclid's book was used directly to teach basic geometry to students. One of the most brilliant scientists and inventors of this time was Archimedes. He lived on the Greek colony of Syracuse, which is on the island of Sicily. And he's someone who was always tinkering with things, creating mechanical devices. And he ended up inventing all sorts of ingenious machines. He used things that had pumps, pulleys, and he also invented a number of military devices. He was also talented in the field of mathematics. He's the person who established the value of pi. And he also came up with a lot of the methods used to calculate the area and volume of complex geometric shapes. His particular delight was building contraptions which could move water from one level to another. And the most famous of these was a thing called the Archimedean screw. This was obviously named after him, and even today it remains the basis for many pumps. He also had a real flair for using levers, pulleys, block and tackle systems to magnify force and to move or lift heavy objects. One of his famous sayings was, "Give me a lever and a place to stand, and I can move the world." The best known anecdote about Archimedes has to do when the local ruler asked him to solve a complex problem that had to do with the purity of a golden crown. And Archimedes was stumped by this. He just couldn't solve it. So finally he decided, I'll take a break. I'll go visit the local bath and have a nice relaxing soak. And as he stepped into the bath, he noticed that his body displaced an equal volume of water. And this led him to a sudden realization of a way that he could solve that problem. So elated at this, he immediately jumped up and ran home through the streets, completely naked and dripping water, shouting, "Eureka! Eureka!" Meaning, "I found it." And as memorable and famous as that story is, it may actually be a later invention. But it does capture an accurate sense of this great scientist's obsessive devotion to his intellectual pursuits. Unfortunately, that very same dedication would result in his death. Syracuse was attacked by the Romans, and even though Archimedes could prolong the defense with some of his clever war machines, eventually the Romans break in. And the Roman general had given his men specific orders not to harm Archimedes. The Romans hoped to gain his services for themselves. But when the soldiers burst into his lab, Archimedes was so intent on a complex mathematical diagram that he was working on, that he just ignored their demands to identify himself, and so he was killed. He was buried in a tomb which was decorated with a sphere and a cylinder, and that symbolizes his mathematical insights. Other inventions of various Hellenistic scientists include cogged gears, pulleys, the screw, glass blowing, hollow bronze casting, surveying instruments, an odometer, the water clock, and even a sort of spectacular musical instrument known as the water organ. But often all this ingenuity was not applied to practical things, but instead a lot of it was used for trickery. For example, one famous inventor of the time was named Hero of Alexandria, and his nickname was the Mechanic. And Hero constructed an automated puppet theater complete with doors that would appear to open on their own, statues that would come out and come to life and move their arms around, and bowls that would apparently never empty, so they would pour out wine from invisible reservoirs. And many of all these Hellenistic inventions today we would think of as being the kinds of stuff that would be used by magicians or illusionists. And in fact, the Greek word mekane, from which the word mechanic is derived, originally meant a trick. One source of money and patronage for a lot of these inventors were the rulers of the Hellenistic kingdoms. And these autocrats were very fond of staging huge public spectacles. Basically, they were practicing what today we would call conspicuous consumption. For example, Ptolemy II of Egypt organized a grand parade in Alexandria, which by any measure, I think, puts to shame modern counterparts such as the Rose Bowl parade. Ptolemy's procession included not just his army, so there were chariots and war elephants and soldiers, but it also had giant floats, which had larger-than-life-size mechanical statues of gods and heroes moving their limbs. There were more floats with huge paintings of historical and mythological scenes. There were also actors dressed up as satyrs, these sort of half-men, half-goats. There were 120 boys carrying saffron on golden platters. And there was a special float that had a colossal wineskin, which was stitched together from leopard pelts and had a 30,000-gallon capacity. And this thing would spray free wine out into the spectators' eager mouths. In addition, there was a menagerie of exotic animals. There were giraffes, antelopes, parrots, elephants, a gnu, camels, peacocks, a rhinoceros, a white bear, ostriches pulling carts, 2,000 oxen painted gold, and 2,400 dogs. And finally, to top it all off, there was a 180-foot-long gold-plated phallus with a giant ribbon and bow tied around it. The city of Alexandria was a center of learning, and it had the famous Library of Alexandria. This was a wonderful repository of knowledge, and it had as its goal to collect one copy of every book in existence. And modern scholars estimate it had maybe 500,000 scrolls. Every ship that docked at Alexandria was searched by customs officials. And if they were able to find a book on the ship that was not yet owned by the library, they would confiscate it until a copy could be made. Attached to the library was an institution called the Museum, literally the House of the Muses. And this was both a place to collect and store interesting or unusual objects, and also a kind of center for advanced research. And scholars would come from all over the ancient world to study at Alexandria. And there they would do research, collect data, do experiments, and then write up these scholarly treatises on their findings. And the subject matter of these essays ranges very widely. From a review of every known poison to texts on agriculture and beekeeping. And research in Alexandria reached a very high level of sophistication. And soon people began to criticize some of these scholars on the grounds that their work was so hopelessly obscure and that the topics they researched had no practical applications, an accusation often leveled against modern scholars. Just so you can judge for yourself, let me give you a couple titles of some actual texts written during the Hellenistic period. One was A Collection of Rare Words Used by Democritus. Another was On Words Suspected of Not Having Been Used by Earlier Writers. And one that must have been a really exciting read, On Changes of Names of Fishes. The Ptolemaic rulers of Egypt funded this library, and they took pride in it. It was a status symbol. Being very competitive, the other Hellenistic kings soon set up their own competing libraries. And so you had a kind of war of books to see which king could own the biggest library. None of the other libraries ever really got close, though, to matching the Great Library of Alexandria. Mirroring their patrons' animosity, rival scholars also engaged in bitter academic feuds over erudite topics. And again, this would be familiar at any large research university today. All of this intellectual and diplomatic activity made Greek the common international language of this time. In an earlier lecture, I described the archaic and classical styles of Greek sculpture. The Hellenistic era is the third major style of Greek art, and it has its own distinctive characteristics in terms of the sculpture which was produced then. And Hellenistic sculpture has three main characteristics. First of all, a lot of the sculptures which were carved at this time have an interest in showing moments or incidents of extreme drama, in trying to capture moments of intense emotion. And a nice example of this is a very popular and then widely copied statue, which is called the Dying Gaul. So it shows a barbarian from Gaul, and we know this because he has a mustache, which is very characteristic of Gaulish barbarians, and he's just been stabbed and has fallen to the ground. And with the very last of his strength, he's struggling to sort of hold his body upright. And so what it does is it captures this single moment which is weighted with deep drama right before his death and great emotion. As time goes on, there's almost a sense that Hellenistic artists are competing with one another to see who could portray the most extreme emotional moment. So another much imitated statue that dates a few years later shows another dying Gaul, but this time he's plunging a sword into his own chest while he holds the corpse of his wife. And the story behind this artwork is that his village is being overrun by enemies, and so rather than be captured, he's killed his wife and is now killing himself. So what's more dramatic than a dying man? Well, the answer offered by this artist is a man who just killed the woman he loves and is now killing himself. The second characteristic of Hellenistic sculpture is a new obsession with realism. And this represents a dramatic change or departure from the previous classical era's focus on idealized, young, perfect, beautiful bodies. Hellenistic sculptors still make some of those. For example, the Gauls I've just talked about are wonderful examples of male physique. But now artists also create very realistic statues of non-perfect bodies, including even old or diseased people. Kind of a weirdly popular genre from this era is lots of sculptures of elderly homeless people, in which every wrinkle and sagging muscle is carefully and vividly rendered. A famous example of this is a statue of a drunk, old, toothless beggar woman clutching a pot of wine. And that's a long way from the perfect, poised young athletes of classical era sculpture. Maybe, also as part of this new realism, women finally are depicted fully nude. Finally, Hellenistic sculpture also has an amazing technical virtuosity, as if the sculptors were self-consciously trying to show off their skills at carving stone. And the most famous of all Hellenistic statues just exudes that quality, as well as the other two I already mentioned. This is a statue called the Laocoon. And it illustrates an episode from the end of the Trojan War when the Greeks pretend that they've given up the siege, and so they leave behind the big wooden horse. Now, of course, as you know, the horse is filled with soldiers, and the Greeks are hoping the Trojans will pull it inside the city so that the men can jump out and capture the city. Well, the Trojans are fooled by this, so they are planning to bring the horse in. But alone among them is a priest named Laocoon. And he sees through the trick. And so he urges the Trojans, don't bring in the horse. But the gods want Troy to fall. So they send a giant snake to murder Laocoon and silence his warning. And before throttling Laocoon, the snake also crushes to death his two young sons. And so the actual statue shows all three, father and two sons, wrapped in the serpent's coils. And these figures are shown with supreme realism. and the whole complex twining of limbs and snakes, it's just a tour de force of artistic skill. And finally, the sculptor here, I think, has captured what is maybe the ultimate moment of intense emotion. For not only is Laocoon himself dying, but he's just witnessed the murder of his family, and even worse, because he can't give his warning, he knows his entire culture is doomed to extinction. Now, if it seems that Hellenistic art has a little bit of a morbid fascination with scenes of despair and death, there's probably some truth to that. Just like with philosophy, it's tempting to see the art of this time as reflecting what's going on in society. And one valid way to interpret the great flourishing of scientific and intellectual achievements which happened during the Hellenistic era is to see it as inspired by, or maybe in response to, the often quite unpleasant reality of the historical situation. Thank you.